far past the heartland of Avesseria, further than even wealthy and haughty Aranoi. Along the waters of the Brass Sea, and in a land of endless grass, lay a people who were seemingly like demons. These peoples, they had rode on horseback, and no man had ever seen one of their faces. Not their true ones, at least. They always hid them under a mask of stone and rock. They were warriors, they were riders, and they were the terrors of Cathun Kai and Catharati. Jadzik had found such statements funny. He'd been riding along a stream, tending to a small flock of animals. He sat on top of his horse while waiting for a moment and allowing the sheep to drink. And so his thoughts flowed like the running water. Sure, his people were hardened through generations of life on the steppes, and yes, there had been many periods of time where his ancestors might have gone on raids and small military excursions. Jadzik wouldn't deny it. His grandfather often regaled him with great stories of Otuched, Khagr-Khatan of the Eorn Horde, how the mighty riders of that great leader devastated the lands of Cathun Kai, and after a period of boredom, he'd even led his soldiers down into Kashria. But Jadzik? Jadzik had always been a shepherd, moving from one part of the Kolgri steppes to another, always in sight of the Aranoian mountains. His father too had been a shepherd, and as much as his grandfather thought himself otherwise, he too had been the same. A warrior? A devastating raider who set fires to towns and villages? Jadzik chuckled at the thought. Such actions were for greater individuals, more adventurous and more ambitious folk. People who would destroy the world if they could. For Jadzik, he was content to allow himself his pastures and his animals. He was a rich man if the seasons were kind and the winters didn't kill a chunk of his flock. What more could he ask for? And so, after waiting a period, Jadzik began to move his sheep onward. They drank their fill, and the time to move was now. And in an instant, the world seemed to change. Half of his sheep seemed to explode into fiery blood. Entrails and debris seemed to mix in the air before dissipating entirely. Jadzik could feel immense heat, could hear 1,000 bleats, the screams of terror and confusion amongst his animals. His horse panicked, and Jadzik was thrown off. He could feel a sharp crunch as his arm bent completely in an unnatural angle. And then it seemed to go missing completely. Jadzik turned back, witnessing the world around him turn into a strange tint. And then the world seemed to sigh. The earth shook, rumbled, undulated. Jadzik fell once more. He began crying. And then the moon seemed to crack. Avalor shattered before Jadzik's eyes. And then he fell into darkness, terror, and then death. Such was the terror of that day, of the 3rd January in the year 1200. Frogbrokna, when the world was destroyed. And welcome back to another April 1st edition of the Nomads and Empires podcast. Today, we're switching gears and focusing a bit on a mysterious group that exists in the lands east of Avesseria. But it may be necessary to think wider for a second and consider the very world that we're talking about. The world of Eris, and to break the fourth wall somewhat briefly, it is the world in which the Crusader Kings 3 mod, Gudhrja, takes place, is a diverse and complicated world. The known world of Eris is dominated by two main continents, Greater Avesseria and Ceridon. Greater Avesseria consists of the lands in the north of the Shattered Coast, including subregions such as Shivali, Aranoi, and Catarati. Here, the weather is cool, temperate, and the northern reaches are dominated by forest and taiga. Ceridon, due to its more southerly position, is arid and dominated by deserts, though large humid jungles can be found as one journeys even further south. The history of these lands has been effectively controlled by the two greatest powers of the day. the theocratic state of Ceridon, and to an even more influential sense, the great empire of Aversaria. We'll quickly describe the histories of these polities, as understanding the steppe and its peoples requires an assessment of the great powers that surrounded it, especially when we consider the events of Hrodbrokna in 1200. Both of these realms employed powerful weapons and magi to accomplish their aims. Ceridonian warlords and magi waged endless war over sectarian differences and religious causes, and they had killed millions of their own after casting the self-replicating blood magic in 802. This depopulated Ceridon and led to generations of anarchy and strife, and in many ways, the continent remains a shell of its former glory. The Aversarians in their empire were even more powerful, even more influential, and even more deadly than the Ceridonians. The Aversarians would create a vast empire that stretched across the Shattered Coast, reaching far to the south and even extending along the coast of Ceridon itself. And yet it was a brutal state, ruled by bloodthirsty magi and power-hungry warlords. Many realms became colonies of the Aversarians. Millions were enslaved, and even more were tortured and killed. Such a state was prone to infighting, and over the course of the empire's millennia stretching existence, countless civil wars and revolts would break out. The most devastating and consequential would be the Imperial Civil War. As is stated in one of the annals of Aversaria, quote, "While Aversaria had faced many civil wars, only one would become known as the Imperial Civil War," unquote. It would also be Aversaria's last. From 1186 to 1200 of the Imperial Standard, the Imperial Civil War devastated the empire. On one side was the wife of the late emperor Anamasios Axiothea. On the other was a former general of Anamasios, Ashuraeus. Our story is not focused on Axiothea or Ashuraeus, or even on the history of Aversaria, but the course of the civil war would have reverberations that impacted not just the empire, not just the steppes, but the entire world. In a desperate attempt at winning the war, Ashuraeus conducted a ritual to cast the deadliest of spells, the self-replicating blood magic. In 1200, millions would die. Those who came into contact with the self-replicating blood magic would effectively ignite into a fiery blaze. Any in close proximity would then likewise catch the spell, almost like a plague. Self-replicating blood magic was quick, and it was especially potent for those with magical ability. It would ignite, and then spread, and then ignite, and then spread, and soon much of the Aversarian Empire had become victims of the unquenchable fire Ashuraeus had unleashed. It is believed that half of the Aversarian population and a quarter of the world's population perished in this single event. And yet, that was not all. The spell had temporarily awoken a great being. To the far northeast, in the forest and taiga of the Siavolki people, an old god seemed to gasp at the immense killing and desolation that occurred. It was a moment, but it was a moment too long. Immediately after Ashuraeus had launched a spell, Hrodbrokna began. In moments, the world changed completely. The moon Avalar exploded into millions of shards. Magical ley lines seemed to malfunction, and millions more died in a motley of cruel and unexplainable ways. In the lands of the Siavolki, a great fog had begun to manifest, choking the life of anything that lived, blanketing the lands it touched forever in darkness and mist. It corrupted everything it touched, and great monsters known as fog beasts emerged from the wisp. From Hrodbrokna came the fog, the ever-moving haze that could not be stopped. Those along the borders of the fog were forced to migrate, to move in great numbers lest they be consumed by the fog and become one with it. What the fog was, some had ideas, sure. None of them really mattered. The fog would slowly push across the world and consume everything in its path. These events are what shaped the world today. Looking at things from a snapshot view in the present, in 1254 of the Imperial Standard, we are presented with a world in flux. The Imperial Civil War, Frodbrokna, and the fog all played instrumental roles in changing the socio-political and economic fabrics of every single polity. Whether Avasarian, Ceredonian, or from the steppe, every person was impacted by these disasters, and every state had to contend with the decay that was now set on the world. And so on today's episode, our focus turns eastward toward a land in eastern Avasaria known as Aranoi. Aranoi had once been a province of the Avasarian Empire and was a rich and wealthy land. The civil war depopulated it, and many parts were permanently marred. Yet this would provide others with opportunity. There were the mass migrations of the Siavolki, a people of the north who had fled the fog that destroyed their homelands. They were led by a man named Kenware Witchbreaker, though his story is not ours to follow today. More indigenous than the Siavolki were a people known as the Old Tennis. These were a people of the Kolgri steppe, located just east of Aranoi and generally considered a part of Aranoi itself, though it often escaped total domination by the Avasarians. Somehow, in the great disasters of the 13th century, the Oltenic people had survived all of these events. They were lessened in number, but they remained able to maintain their way of life and had done so despite being surrounded by enemies over the last millennia. And so on today's episode of the Nomads and Empires podcast, we will be covering the history of the Oltenic people, a nomadic steppe group defined by a cultural practice of mask wearing and a fervent desire to continue living despite the dying world. As always, we should start by analyzing the geography that defined the Oltenic people. The core of Oltenic culture is defined by the Kolgri steppe, sometimes known as the Oltenic steppe. It has been described as, quote, a vast expanse of open land stretching from the Aranoian Mountains in western Aranoi to the Kasiriyat River in the far east, unquote. The northern edge of the Kolgri steppe is marked by the Brass Sea, which itself is home to a wide variety of ecosystems, including barrier islands, marshlands, and estuaries. Just beyond the Brass Sea were the coastal highlands of Amagia, and even further lay the Armazli Mountains. Perhaps the most significant feature that influences the Kolgri steppes actually lays beyond the Kasiriyat River. Here, the Hiartan Mountains, the highest in all of Greater Avasaria, dominate and effectively box the Oltenic people away from further eastward expansion, though that hasn't always been successful. Finally, word should be given for the southern reaches of the steppe. The steppe gradually transitions from grasslands to more arid and rocky terrain as one moves south. Precipitation in the south is rare, and there are many chasms and canyons scattered around. The lands furthest to the south are the Redlands, a mysterious area of caverns and ravines. A whole litany of odd cults and dangerous monsters are said to reside there, and very few Oltenic writers would dare challenge such a place. And of course, once one passes the Redlands, one would be caught by the Sea of Empires, and nothing more was left except for wide ocean, and eventually, Ceredon. And with that set, let's now take a deeper look at the Oltenic people. Indeed, the term Oltenis mostly refers to the wider religious views of the steppe peoples, and there is a rather sharp diversity in terms of culture and belief. What then can we actually say broadly about the peoples living here? Like other steppe groups, the Oltenic peoples are defined by their existence on the wide grasslands. Crucial to this form of life was the domestication of the horse. The horse enabled the Oltenic peoples wider mobility and facilitated a nomadic herding lifestyle. We can imagine that these cultures would have herded sheep, goats, cattle, and of course horses. And by the virtue of this animal husbandry, Oltenic communities would have wandered across the plains in search of water and new pastures when old ones became depleted or when harsh winters came. The usual patterns of violence and coercion may have also moved steppe groups across the grasslands. These steppe communities developed further into polities and organized states. We aren't provided with much information on the inner workings of these states, but we have a few points. It is known that the Oltenis organized themselves in clan structures, though it is unclear if these clans were formed by an entire grouping of those with similar familial descent, that is, if everyone in the clan descended from a single family or leader, or if these clans were formed by an illustrious core of interrelated members and whose other members came from subservient or vassal families, as is the model postulated by Christopher Atwood's appendage theory of steppe organization. Though these clans could often have substantial differences, there were some broad similarities as far as political structures are concerned. Leading the Oltenic clan was the Khatan, who held supreme authority over the clan and its warriors. A Khatan would then be served by a number of sub-commanders and governors known as the Beys. These Beys may control an allotted territory of pasture land that ultimately derived from the Khatan. The Beys were further supported by a number of chieftains, though the word for such leaders is not known at this time. Though generally these leaders were male, women were known to rule, particularly if they had no brothers or were substantially powerful. Oltenic society practiced and valued a number of similar aspects. Though there are several cultures, most Oltenic individuals spoke some form of the Vanavid language. Culturally, many of them valued horsemanship, valued warriorship, and valued loyalty. Perhaps the most defining feature amongst most of the Oltenic peoples comes from their religion. This faith, which gives us the very name Oltenic, is marked by several key qualities. To most individuals, whether they be Siavolki, Avisarian, or Kashrian, the most one may know about the Oltenis are their mask. These masks are worn in nearly all occasions, only taken off during important and intimate moments. When one does remove their mask, it is considered, quote, a sign of pure loyalty and vulnerability, unquote. This particular facet, this wearing of mask, derives from an Oltenic myth. As the myth goes, quote, the Oltenis believe that the world is divided into two spheres, the sky, realm of the benevolent father, Olgin Ten, and the earth, realm of the malevolent mother, Yeru Mai. Yeru Mai once tried to slay her husband in a fit of jealousy, but was stopped by their eldest son, Ulik, at the cost of his life. Their second son, Kalgin, covering his face at the sight, fled and swore to never build a home of earth or harvest its fruits. And from Kalgin's loins came all the peoples of the steppe, unquote. Building on this, another account gives us this further explanation. Quote, the Oltenis believe that if they leave their faces exposed for too long, jealous Yeru Mai will identify them as Kalgin's children and steal away their souls. Thus, they conceal themselves with face masks which they always wear when outside or in the company of others. Unquote. As seen from this myth, the Oltenic faith and its differing sects are generally polytheistic, worshipping a number of gods and goddesses. There are other notable similarities. Most forms of Oltenism practice a kind of ancestor worship, and give reverence to the deeds and legends of their predecessors. In extreme cases, such as that of the Ik Otuched, this can result in an almost deification of preceding individuals. Astrology and divination also play sizable roles in the majority of Oltenic beliefs, and so the stars and the heavenly bodies have a profound influence on the Oltenic peoples. It is likely that the shattering of Eivor during the Hrodbrokna would have caused chaos or been perceived as an evil omen to the various Ultenic clans, though sadly, we have no accounts as to what people actually associated this event with. It surely must have been traumatic. Beyond the heavens, there were several physical sites that were of significance to the Ultenic steppe groups. In the southern grasslands, near the Janav River, lies the gravesite of Beitor. Beitor was a grandson of the great warlord Otiched. Beitor was a Khatan of the Otiched Empire and had led his horde in a war against the Astilic Empire in western Aranoi. Beitor would perish in the Battle of the Wall of Astilla, with legends stating that his body would flow along the Janav River until it reached its current resting spot. Since then, it has become a pilgrimage site. An even more important location lies deep in the center of the Kolgri Steppes. Here, a vast tower rises up into the air. Like its siblings in Ceridon and in the Sea of Empires, it is a mysterious monument from a far bygone era. It is said to have magical properties and is held to be sacred by the Ultenis. According to them, quote, "The tower is a physical connection between their two gods, Ulgin Ten and Yerumai. To guard the tower is seen as a high honor for the Ultenis and a rite of passage amongst the young," unquote. Now, of course, as we've hinted throughout this episode, the Ultenic peoples are not a single, wholly united entity. Though there have been epochs of unity and cohesion, the steppe communities have always contained a blanket of diversity. Across the Kolgri steppes are different cultures and religious nuances, and that is something we should explore as well. As of 1254, the Ultenic peoples are separated into a number of known culture groups. These consist of names such as the Koridorag, the Muhadim, the Mur-Arut, the Jarvid, and the Khurinot. Given the nature of the steppe, it can be difficult to pinpoint the exact geographic divides of these different cultures. The Koridorag, for instance, can be found in both the eastern end of the steppe and near the western border with Aranoi. Various Mur-Arut communities exist just south of the Brass Sea, but also not too far from the coast of the Sea of Empires. The historical trajectory of the Ultenis lends to this surely, as the various migration movements across the ages would have resulted in a mosaic of different population centers all along the steppe. As such, we should not consider these cultures as stagnant entities that never change. Rather, there would have been a variance in this, that peoples intermingled and identities would have shifted. Of course, cultural differences were there. The Khurinot are defined by a strong sense of loyalty that appears unparalleled when compared to other Ultenic groups. The Muhadim value justice and modesty and are known to be quite zealous. Then there were the Mur-Arut, who had a deep oral tradition and were renowned as poets and storytellers. Differences could also be found in religion, as the Ultenic faith would find itself splintered by different sects and nuances. These various faiths generally maintained the core ideas of Ultenism, but could also vary rather wildly. Some, such as the Ik-Otoshed, were conservative. The Ik-Otoshed remains mostly in alignment with Ultenism, though special reverence is given to the historical warlord Otoshed. Indeed, this reverence would lead to the apotheosis of Otoshed into one of the Ultenic gods. The Aray-Murug and Ebohef-Ulgin sects differ in deities as well. Adherents of the Aray-Murug faith, sometimes described as air worship, believe that the wind contains a sort of spirituality or holiness. To them, wind is a direct consequence of gods interacting with the world, and as a result, these individuals will use wind movements rather than celestial bodies in their divination. Those of the Ebohef-Ulgin faiths believe in a number of spirits and fire gods, and have a mythology that is both similar and pretty distinct from the more orthodox Ultenic faith. This faith is rather interesting, and I will cite a small passage describing its myths in greater detail. Quote, The god Arlekhan was slain by the jealous goddess Arumen, who desired to usurp the throne of Ebuheth-Ulgan. As he descended to Eris, however, Arlekhan fought Arumen and her 5,000 demon spirits, subduing them and banishing her to the Mountain of Pain. Due to this, Ebuhefi, adherents of the faith, do not hate the land, instead considering it sacred and burying their people in a type of burial mound known as a kurgan. They give worship to Arlekhan and his 5,000 demon spirits and 100 fire gods. His brother, Kolganhei, was given dominion of all under the sky, and from him issued forth the race of man. Unquote. Other faiths developed differences because of their proximity to outside powers and peoples. Most notably is the sect of Chakari, which is actually found rather far from the steppe. Found more so in Kashriya, this splinter of Ultenism is a syncretic faith that combines Ultenic beliefs, worship of the warlord Ulticed, and Kashrian deities and philosophy into a single religion. Here we can make an important segue. The Ultenic peoples have always existed in an area between other lands. Avesaria, Kathun Kai, and Kashriya have all played an important role in influencing Ultenic belief, practices, and culture. The inverse is equally true, and in many ways, the inhabitants of the Ultenic steppe were key in shaping the history of the known world. And so now that we've analyzed the culture and religious makeup of the steppe, let us examine their history and their impact on the wider world. The earliest days of the Cold Gray Steppe were marked by proto-Ultenic peoples. These were probably a smattering of different steppe cultures that melded together into the modern Ultenic groups. We don't have much information to go on about this ancient period of time, but records indicate that even in this long-distant past, the steppe communities here were at odds with the neighboring state of Kathun Kai. Nomadic warbands, especially from the northeastern area of the steppe, often raided the borders of Kathun Kai. These warbands then would push further and further into the state, likely driven by further opportunities for wealth and tribute. Eventually, these warbands would push so far into Kathun Kai that they would become vulnerable to an imperial army or mercenary band, and in most cases, these nomadic packs would be destroyed or routed. This pattern of raiding, continued push, and then destruction by Kathun Kai appears to have been a regular one, as evidenced by Ultenic oral traditions and the meticulous records from Kathun Kai itself. As conflict between the steppe and Kathun Kai intensified, powerful leaders would emerge to disrupt this pattern. Such leaders were able to unite the various steppe communities into a single force. From there, they would assail Kathun Kai directly, striking at the heartland of the empire. In most cases, the emperors of Kathun Kai would be successful in driving out the nomads, and very energetic rulers would attempt to subdue the steppe by building border forts on the Cold Gray Steppe directly. And so for many generations, the steppe and Kathun Kai maintained this tense, back-and-forth type of relationship. It is likely that in this time, the proto-Ultenic peoples also engaged in raids and military expeditions toward their other neighbors, such as communities living in the southern coast or further westward in Aranoi proper. Though we have few specific accounts from this era, one of the most famous proto-Ultenic figures would be that of Uruchad. Uruchad was a steppe leader who had long since participated in the conflict between Kathun Kai and the proto-Ultenic peoples. We don't have much to go on about Uruchad specifically, but we can deduce that during this period, Uruchad would have participated in a number of raids and border skirmishes with Kathun armies and auxiliaries. The saga of Uruchad would take place around 30 years prior to the more infamous campaign known as the Khair Selni Darn, led by Ulticed. And yet it would be Uruchad who would lay the foundations for Ulticed to follow. And so during the reign of the Kathun Emperor Shu Yuan Shuwu, Uruchad would invade Kathun Kai with around 1,000 warriors. Although many preceding steppe invasions would see some successes followed by utter defeat, Uruchad was different. As his forces pushed further and further into Catherine territory, more and more steppe warriors would follow. A tipping point occurred when Orochad successfully defeated the governor of the state of Iyan, a man named Mai Wan. It is said that once this defeat occurred, the Cathuni military collapsed, and Orochad and his forces would capture many of the states along the Gaihen Road. The Gaihen Road was the main trade artery of Cathun Kai, and its disruption directly threatened the deeper heartland of the empire. And due to this capture, Orochad's military expedition is often dubbed the Gaihen Campaign. The Gaihen Campaign would be a significant moment for the histories of the steppe and of Cathun Kai. In an unprecedented move, Orochad and his warriors were able to march deeper into Cathun territory, and with the capture of the Gaihen Road, the way was now open to the empire's capital, Loen Chayon. Attacks on Loen Chayon are rare and are considered a grave insult according to Cathun records. As it is said, quote, Emperor Zhu Yuan Shuwu, whom had been too afeared of the increasingly infamous Orochad, was finally stirred to action when he realized he was able to spot the camping Ultenic horde from his capital. This was a grievous and humiliating insult to the emperor, as Cathuni tradition says only those of pure spirit and blood who properly supplicated before the emperor's representatives could even view the beautiful city. Unquote. The sheer fact that a, according to their eyes, barbarian horde had approached their glorious capital meant that Emperor Shu Yuan Shuwu had failed in his duties. Suddenly, the emperor was beset by internal dissent, and a coup appeared to be on the horizon. In response, the emperor quickly mobilized his personal forces, something that had never been done during the emperor's reign, and soon, Cathuni armies clashed with the invading steppe riders. Though we have few details on what exactly occurred, it likely would have been a titanic battle, and in the end, Orochad was slain and his horde was sundered. The consequences of the Gaihen campaign would be numerous. For Cathun Kai, the war would destabilize the empire immensely and greatly delegitimize the reign of Shu Yuan Shuwu. In short time, Cathun Kai would experience a great famine and then face even greater disaster in the form of a revolt known as the Chinyancha Panulan, or the Thousand Summer Rebellion. The reverberation of Orochad's actions were perhaps even greater on the steppe. For the first time in the centuries-long war with Cathun Kai, the steppe nomads had succeeded in striking deep into the empire's heart. The various clans and polities of the grasslands had united and become a force unimaginably strong. Now, there was a framework and a legacy that could be channeled and turn the peoples of the Kolgri steppes into something more. All it would take would be another leader, someone equally as powerful and as charismatic as Orochad, or perhaps someone even greater. And so came the rise of Ultochad, and with him the consolidation of the modern Ultenic identity. The early history of Ultochad is unknown. What we can guess is that he almost certainly came from the Kolgri steppe and likely descended from one of the noble clans. He may have been alive for the Gaihen campaign, or at least had relatives who had been associated with it. Either way, the feats of Orochad were in living memory still, and may have had an influence on Ultochad. What we do know is that Ultochad would become a prominent steppe leader, and his charisma and prowess became notable. He was able to amass a great following, and would eventually form the largest army ever possessed by an Ultenic Khatan. Perhaps the most notable characteristic of Ultochad was his weapon, the legendary sword Eorn-Seld. Let us take a moment to explore this mystical blade. Eorn-Seld, or the Sword of Eons in the Ultenic tongue, is a sword that has had a long history on the steppe. According to Ultenic legends, the sword was once owned by the first human Ulic, who himself was son of the Great Sky Father, Olgin Ten. It is unknown what happened to the blade after Olic was killed by his mother, Yerumai, but eventually, so the story goes, it would end up in a different realm or universe. Ulticed would eventually rediscover the sword, but only after he had slain a dragon and found a portal in the dragon's mouth. The portal would then take him to the resting place of Eorin Seld. Clearly, destiny was on Ulticed's side. There remain rather interesting debates about Eorin Seld. Avrasarian scholars have long argued whether or not the blade even existed. Similar debates have occurred over the function of Eorin Seld in Ulticed's rule, whether it truly was a magical blade, or if it was a useful construction to create a sense of prestige and legitimacy for Ulticed. Eorin Seld is now, sadly, lost to time, and so these debates may never be solved, but we'll get there in a bit. For now, let us turn back to Ulticed, now armed with Eorin Seld. With this blade, Ulticed would be able to amass a great following, and as has always seemingly been tradition, Ulticed would now turn his attention toward Cathun Kai and retrace the steps of his predecessor, Ulticed. 30 years after Ulticed's demise, Ulticed would lead an army across the frontiers, striking at Cathun Kai's border forts and crossing into Imperial territory. Thus began the Khair Selni Darn, or the War of Two Swords. The Khair Selni Darn would become one of the most devastating wars of its day. The Ultenic army defeated many of the Cathuni border forts and they began a meticulous campaign in the Cathuni state of Cheungje. Though outnumbered 3-1, Ulticed would successfully sack the capital of this province, Haojin. Yet we should remember that this war was known as the War of Two Swords, and while Ulticed and Eorin Seld were ravaging the lands of Cheungje, another hero with another great sword was readying a counterattack. Xiao Yaeun Zhang, one of the greatest leaders and warriors in Cathun Kai at the time. Zhang bore the blade known as Eong Faing, or the Whispering Wind. It is said that Zhang's brother had perished in the sack of Haojin, and so motivated by vengeance, Zhang headed to the imperial court. There, he requested permission for the emperor to lead a force against Ulticed and his invasion army. Emperor Zhu Jiang Xiaoyuan agreed and sent with Zhang 3 of his personal armies, as well as a company of Magi. Zhang's army was further bolstered by militia forces from 4 other provinces, and soon, the Cathun Kai counterforce marched toward the land of Kairong, a hilly place in Cheungje. And at Kairong, Xiao Yaung Zhang and his Cathuni forces met Khatan Ulticed and his Ultenic horde. The land was hilly, and both sides possessed an unprecedented number of soldiers and weapons. The Cathuni army contained at least 100,000 men, if the records are to be believed. And both sides were guided by their legendary blades, Eorin Seld and Eung Faing, the Sword of Eons and the Whispering Wind. Zhang first hoped to take advantage of elevation. He secured himself on the hills of Kairang and then ordered one of his generals to engage the Ultenic army. After a period of fighting, the general would then retreat and bring Ulticed's forces into Kairang, a feint retreat. Such a tactic proved to be successful, with the Ultenic army taking the bait and chasing down the Cathun force. Zhang took his chance and ambushed Ulticed and his men. The immense numbers and great animosity between the two forces would have meant that the battle was chaotic and frenzied. It appears that Zhang and his army had a tactical advantage, being entrenched on uphill territory and having the element of surprise. But battles have a way of giving course to even greater confusion, and whether by chance or by fate, it is believed that Khatan Ulticed and Xiao Yaeun Zhang found themselves facing one another in pitched combat. The two great swords swung at each other. Metal clashed with metal. And then the province was destroyed. According to legends, once the blades connected with each other, a powerful explosion erupted. The blast radius was so large that it devastated the entirety of the Cheongje state. Of the hundreds of thousands of participants, only a few hundred survived the battle. Miraculously, Zayang and Otuched lived, and the remnant forces quickly retreated away from the ruined lands of Cheongje. Zayang and his sword would soon disappear from the annals of history. Folk tales believe that Zayang resigned from the emperor's service in shame and began a wandering life as a sellsword. The legacy of Aeong Faiang has been felt even as far north as Shivali, and perhaps Zayang's wanderings took him across many lands in Eris, though this is just speculation. As for Otuched, this defeat was only the beginning of his legacy. Tales of the Khair Selnidarn, tales of the great duel with Zayang, and tales of the destruction of Kathunkai's forces quickly spread across the steppe. Though many steppe clans had participated in the Khair Selnidarn, there still remained some disunity in the land. But now, with his prestige even greater than before, Otuched would soon embark on a grand project: the true unification of the Ultenic peoples. In the early 4th century of the Imperial Standard, Otuched would use diplomacy, guile, and strength to turn the divided Ultenic steppe into a single, unified polity. The actual process of unification remains unclear to this day, but many clans had participated in the Khair Selnidarn, and many knew of the prowess Otuched possessed. Furthermore, these clans likely lost a large number of able fighting men in the Battle of Khairong. Perhaps there was little choice but to unite and band together, for if they were divided and heavily depleted of manpower, outside forces could descend upon the steppe. This new unified state would be known as the Eorn Horde, named after the sword Eorn Seld. And now with both Eorn's sword and the Eorn Horde, Otuched would once more embark in a campaign of conquest. This time, he would not target Kathunkai. There are several accounts for why. Some scholars believe that Otuched realized his forces could not sustain another major campaign there. More apologetic narratives state that Otuched was bored of fighting the Kathunis. In either case, the end result would be the same. Otuched would unleash the Eorn Horde south, into the lands of Kashuria. The Khair Selnidarn would be somewhat influential, but mostly in matters of legend and myth. The invasion of Kashuria would be influential on history as a whole. In quick succession, the Ultenic armies succeeded in destroying most, if not all, of the Kashurian kingdoms. Once the region had been subdued, Otuched enacted radical policies that changed the patterns and trajectory of Ultenic society. Otuched would declare the formation of an empire. Dubbed by historians as the Otuchedian Empire, it consisted of the entire Kolgri steppe, the lands of Kashuria, and the modern pirate coast. In another departure, Otuched would declare himself a descendant of Olek, the first man, and he named himself the Khagr Khatan, the godlike emperor. To better facilitate his rule, Otuched would develop political systems based on pre-existing Kashurian ones. He led a number of reforms and religious policies that weakened the Verodaist priesthood, and indeed, Otuched was willing to embrace Kashurian culture, technology, and philosophy, and so the region became a melting pot of Kashurian and Ultenic ideas. This melting pot concept extended beyond just ideas. The conquest meant that thousands of Ultenic peoples migrated into Kashuria, and in many cases, this was permanent. Even today, there are remnant Ultenic states in the land practicing either some form of the Ultenic faith or maintaining aspects of that culture. It is possible that a large number of Kashurian individuals have some amount of Ultenic ancestry. Otuched himself is still revered in the region, known as the Chakra Khaitan, and many of the law codes in the area are based off of Otuched's legal codex, the Otuchedian Law. A large number of religious sects contain influences that are directly traced to the Otuchedian Empire, such as the beliefs of the Vidvayukhyatra, It is interesting to consider the sizable influence of Oltached when we contextualize it with his life. You see, Oltached would not live long after the formation of this empire. He would pass away only a few years into his rule, just as he was planning an invasion into Aranoy. The throne would pass to Oltached's son, Iron, who became the Khagakhatan of the Oltachedian Empire. There are few details about Iron's rule. We are told that he was a great and capable ruler, dubbed as one of the four great rulers by the Kashrians. Under his reign, he further developed Oltachedian policies, established a new currency for the empire, and continued his father's clashes with the Kashrian religious establishment. He was also known to have established around 20 new cities. More consequential would be Iron's son and Oltached's grandson, Beitor. Beitor was very much unlike his father and grandfather. Signs of weaknesses came early into his reign, as Beitor was faced by a civil war known as the War of the Five Brothers. Eventually, Beitor would find success, and he would kill two of his brothers, exile another, and, quote, turn his eldest brother Moga into his bondsman, unquote. Though this war was short-lived and not rather destructive, it was the first direct assault on Oltachedian authority, and soon, many other rival families and clans began to conspire and threaten Beitor even more. To re-cement his legacy and his rule, Beitor decided upon an expedition toward Aranoy, then ruled by the Astilic Empire. Known as the Beyurilar, or the Western Journey, this Oltenic invasion would be among the largest since the days of Oltached and Orochad. Historians note that Oltenic armies were, quote, well-supplied, trained, and spirited for a new war. Morale was exceptional, as the generation that marched west believed they were given a chance to earn the glory of their grandfathers, something their own fathers had been unable to achieve, unquote. Crucially, it should be noted that Beitor rode forth with only Oltenic forces, eschewing support from his Kashrian vassals. Initially, Beitor and his armies found great successes in Aranoy. They were able to raid and destroy a number of settlements, and soon found themselves deep into Astilic territory. However, a disastrous situation was unfolding. One of Beitor's vassals, Kurasakai-Khatan, had found himself and his forces surrounded by Astilic soldiers. With the brook preventing them from easy escape, the Oltenic forces were trapped and needed relief. Upon finding out about the situation, Beitor made the fateful decision to rush toward Kurasakai's aid. In a place known as the Wall of Astilla, tragedy struck. As Beitor and his forces forded the brook to save Kurasakai's men, Beitor's horse betrayed him. The horse had lost its footing and threw off Beitor. Beitor descended into the waters. He either died instantly, having slammed his head into a rock, or he would drown due to being weighed down by his armor. In either case, Beitor would lose his life there. The great sword Eornseld would disappear with him into the waters for good. Immediately, the Oltenic army descended into chaos as their Khatan descended into the waters. Somehow, Beitor's brother Moga and Beitor's Kayasheg Ogutai Tangkhatan managed to rally the Oltenic army to at least save Kurasakai-Khatan. The Oltenic army moved forward, forded the brook, and united with Kurasakai's troops. There, they conducted a battle with the Astilic Empire, and though they would eventually be defeated and forced back across the brook, they had managed to save Kurasakai. The death of Beitor meant the death of the Oltachedian Empire. The fraying sinews came apart completely, and there was little concentrated effort to fight in Aranoy. That didn't mean fighting ended. The Beyurilar had mobilized many clans toward Aranoy, and these clans were not yet done with their wars of conquest. Now, though, they would act as independent and competing bands, and so we arrive at a new epoch in Oltenic history, the Aranoian Migration. This period would be marked by the continued invasion of Aranoi by these different Ultenic clans. Chief among these was the saved Kurosaki Khatan, who had become disabled in the fighting at the Wall of Astilla. Soon after, Kurosaki and other independent Khatans succeeded in carving their own realms in Aranoi, though scholars note that many of these states would become destroyed within a generation. By the end of this period, probably around the 5th century of the imperial standard, the Ultenic peoples had greatly influenced the world stage. From Aranoi to Kashria to Kathun Kai, they had influenced political, religious, and military policies for generations to come. The devastation wrought by Ultached meant that the great wars between Kathun Kai and the Ultenic steppe subsided, becoming little more than the occasional border raid and skirmish. In Kashria, the Ultichedian Empire had a direct impact on political and religious society, and even today, there are Ultenic peoples residing in that land. In Aranoi, the great migration of the Ultenic riders placed them in proximity to the Aversarian Empire, and we can imagine that Ultenic auxiliaries would be used by various autocrators and imperial legates. Today, a period of around 800 years later, the steppe is both radically changed and perhaps quite familiar. Of course, the elephant in the room is Fraubrukna. This single event changed history everywhere, and indeed, Ultenic society has almost certainly changed and become traumatized. From the destruction of Avalar to the mass deaths each clan likely experienced, nothing would be the same. Indeed, many of the neighbors of the steppe have radically changed. In western Aranoi, the collapse of the empire and the utter destruction of Opachasia would allow the Siavolki to enter these lands. Some imperial forces remain, such as the stronghold in the far western end of the region, but these forces are smaller and weaker than what had existed prior. Kashria is also quite divided, split among a number of kingdoms and petty realms. The steppes would have also changed dramatically, though our sources speak little about the current situation. Yet remarkably, there remained some consistencies. The land remains divided between different clan leaders, such as the Khirk, the Urduk, and the Tekhayid. The horse remains central, the stars remain divine, and all of them remain fearful of Yerumai, wearing their stone mask lest the angry goddess steals one of the old tennis. And perhaps even still, there remains the possibility, especially in this new and dying world, of another great leader rising up, uniting the steppes and taking the Ultenic people into a single direction to carve a great empire that would last until the world's utter demise. The great enemies, powerful magi, and the fog all loom. It would only take a single charismatic individual to unleash a will of force culminating in the hooves of the Ultenis. But that, time will tell. So yeah, breaking out of character, I wanted to shout out this great mod. Gudhrja is a fantastic world with such a unique setting. I've really fallen in love with the lore and have put way more hours into this than even Vanilla Crusader Kings 3, I think. I would definitely recommend giving this a try if you haven't, and if you haven't played Crusader Kings 3 and are a history fan, you definitely should do so. I'll leave links to the mods and its lore documents in the show notes before, so please go check them out. And with all that said, thank you all for listening to this special and long episode of the Nomads and Empires podcast. Next time, we're back to our normal stuff, and we'll be revisiting the Scythians and exploring the interactions of the Greek world, their colonies, and the Scythian writers. Thanks again, and see you all next time on the windy plains of the Ultenic Steppe.